is totally beside the point. It's not part of the lecture today. But I didn't think we would ever have a day when it wasn't really sunny, so you couldn't really see the screen really well. This is a lousy screen. So I thought I got to seize the time. And I just navigated my way through a lot of complication to get to what I wanted to show you. So if I turn off all the lights, you can maybe even see the screen decently well. So for about 5 minutes, I want to show you something, and then we'll launch into the official class, which is very different than this. Well, I wanted to take you to a world of monsters. And this world of monsters is not out there. It's right there. This is what's in the soil at the Black Forest in Austria. Not Germany, where Black Forest is. Both, probably. But this is live soil. This isn't dead dirt. This is soil that hasn't been ruined. And these are scanning electron microscope pictures. So they're just in grayscale, so they colored them supposedly accurately. They recolored them to show you. So these are the creatures that we don't see that exist on a different level of scale than we do. But I just thought I'd flip through them for you. This is in the September 2022, this past September's National Geographic. This is a tardigrade. This is magnified 24,000 times. I don't know how I go from. Yeah, I guess I go from one to one like this. Okay. And if anybody's totally interested in this, here's the magazine where it looks better. So you come up after class and see it even better than this. But this is the bed. So. Let's keep going and see what else we can find underneath our feet. You can't read there, so for some reason. So these are fungi magnified 7,000 times. Just to show you how beautiful and extraordinary this world is. So fungi multiplied 7,000 times. Then we have that monster is an amoeba. It's actually an amoeba with plates on it. Amoeba are usually very amorphous, right? But this is one with plates on it. It's magnified 11,000 times. It's called a testate amoeba. One-celled animal. Go like this. These are people scooping a handful of dirt from the Black Forest. Okay. So this is it shows a bristle worm at the far left, two types of mites, and this is only magnified 110 times. So this is the bristle worm, and these are the two mites. That guy is a
rotifer.
You're right, it's a rotifer.
Well, I read it.
Oh, man. I haven't seen Rotifer since I was like 15, and I used to watch them in ponds. You know, pond water and with your microscope. Oh, they're rotifers. That's actually a rotifer, and it's magnified 2,400 times. Rotifers go around like this. As I don't know if it's a rotifer. So you can watch them in pond water. They go, that's a rotifer, 2,400 times. Let's see. And these are a variety of things. What did they tell you? One on the left is fruiting body of a slime mold on the upper left, 400 times. Clockwise, so we're now. Whatever way the clock goes, though. Hairy back, it's a hairy back. That's the one to the right top. 2,500 times. A spring tail, which springs 25 times its length, 20 times its length, 100 times. And then on the left, an amoeba, 10,000 times. And maybe there's one more, I think. I'm not sure. Yeah, that one. That's the last one. Yeah, these are absolutely stunning photographs. And this one is mycorrhizal fungi inside the stem of a blueberry. So the fungi are the little things inside the blueberry stem multiplied.
It's a root of a blueberry.
Yeah, it's a blueberry root. Yeah. Excuse me. Cross section of a blueberry root. Yeah. Magnified 2,200 times. So, that's just, it's a blueberry root. Yes. And in there is. So again, that's just to, let's flip back just for a minute so we can have the startling one. Wow. That rotifer was pretty great. That's great. Yeah, there we go. That's 24,000. All right, so. Just because we could take advantage of the fact that it was dark enough in here to be able to do that. What are we doing now? So, first, thank you for coming today.
Yeah.
I had no idea if anyone was going to be here, if we were going to be here. So what I did is I told Carl Blasius, who lives at the top of the mountain, not to come because snow and ice, and you know, I didn't want that scenario to happen. So he's going to come next week and talk to us about advances in biology of aging. It's do come next week. Carl is amazing and crunches amazing amount of complicated information into a very understandable, usable, and fascinating form. So do come. So this is last night, and I'm going, and I have a class planned for after that. But I thought nobody's going to be here today. I can't. That's such an important class that I can't give that class today. So, and I have to put it off because some of you, it's a continuity for some of what we've been trying to understand about the basic nature of the universe. But what are we going to do? And then I went through a whole lot of scenarios that you've already been through. Well, I could do that again. Well, they probably don't remember that, or maybe I'll do this. Finally, I came up with something that I thought was halfway decent because there were going to be only 10 people here anyway, probably just have a discussion. And then I woke up this morning and I thought, oh, I got to do it. It just all fell into place. So it'll be a coherent, hopefully a coherent and interesting lesson this morning, but it certainly did take its time coherent. Any announcements or questions or comments before we sit? Right then, we'll sit for 10 minutes. You can do whatever you like in this sitting. What I would encourage you to do, which is absolutely impossible in 10 minutes, but relevant to the class that we're about to have, is what I would encourage you to do is when you sit, try to discern the deepest level of you. The deepest level of that which is having the experience. And you can do that in 10 minutes. You teach the class, okay? But let's try it, okay? So the question to keep asking yourself is, Who's experiencing this? Look, take attention back to the attender. Put the searchlight on the searchlight and see what happens in 10 minutes or 10 years. That was 11 minutes for those of you who have a biological clock. It occurred to me as I was trying to figure out who I was, actually discerned who I was, that I had forgotten to tell you that if you didn't receive an email about a week and a half ago saying there was no class last week and that Carl Blasius would be coming this week, so if you didn't receive that email, you're not on our email list. And that means you need to, next to your name, print your email so that we can add you to the email list. There are 66 people in the class at this point, and there are only 40-some names on the email list. Something is wrong here.
We did receive the initial email that we were enrolled in the class.
Yeah, but that's not the real email.
No, that's not the yeah. This would have said a week and a half ago, there's no class on 17th. So make sure on the yellow sheet that you print your email address. Okay? Anybody else that didn't receive that email, make sure you do. Otherwise, you can't get emails from us. What you'll get is you'll get pipeline emails, but you don't want to go there. I'm not even going to tell you how to go. You know how to go there, fine, but otherwise, this is part of a larger investigation that we'll probably do forever. But it's about the nature of the self, which we've talked about last year, once before, at least once before. But I want to go deeper into the question of who we are. I'm tabling the question of what the basic nature of the universe is. We're coming back to that in 2 weeks. But for now, it'll be the easier question of who are you? Who am I? Who are we? One way to look at it, of the many, many ways to look... Oh, by the way, the question of the self is a huge question in contemporary psychology. It's one of the major ideas that psychologists are working with. For a long time, it was kind of foreboding, but now it's a chapter in all intro psych textbooks, that kind of thing. What is the self? And of course, there's no definitive answer. And different theorists have said very different things about it throughout psychological history, and I will probably at some point talk about some of those further. But now I want to slice it in a particular way. I want to postulate for this morning that there are three layers or three levels to the self. And what I want to do is show you a short video about the first layer, the layer that we generally consider to be ourselves. Okay? Now, this is by a scientific journalist who is apparently an amazing journalist. He's written on theoretical physics and the basic nature of the universe. He's written on the self. He's written, I don't know what the third thing he wrote on is, but he's finishing another book on the basic nature of AI. He did one on quantum mechanics also. So he's a pretty heady guy. But you'll find out. But this is a beautiful lecture. It really is. You're not necessarily going to agree with what he says entirely, but he certainly says the first level of self interestingly. So let's watch this video, then we'll talk a little about what he said and how other people have said this also. And then we'll move to the second level and then the third level.
And this is one question, and it's probably going to be answered. You're referencing less self. Is there a parallel or a contradictory idea when they just call self, or are they interchangeable terms? for us?
At the level, this first level interchangeable terms.
Okay.
There will be a distinction made more profoundly between the small s self and the capital S self. But not now, not yet. So let's try this. I've got to find out where we're going.
Tell us about these pans. Are they waterproof?
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, I got them from REI a couple of years ago. I told you that the second time I wore them.
Are they waterproof?
Yeah. Yeah, they're called Elements pants, and they were on sale. Everything, you know, come from New York, you wait for the sales, you drive across the town, you get the sale. You know. So they were on sale a couple of years ago. I thought, I already have one. You should see the amount of mountain clothes I have that I'm never going to wear. But I'm addicted to. Oh my God, I can't read that sometimes.
Are they Gore-Tex?
No, there's some other they're not Gore-Tex, but there's some other layer of stuff in them.
But they're waterproof.
Yeah, they're waterproof and they're light and they're real good for hiking. Truthfully, I almost wore my other waterproof pants that I wear all the time. You would have seen the red, they're ratty on the bottom, they're like, but I'm accustomed to them. These are too spiffy for me. So what we need, I think, is the back drapes pulled, because we want to see this reasonably well, and we'll pull those apart. So if somebody would do that on both sides, about to the level of the doors, so we do have some light. I will find this.
Two sets.
Go back to the top. There was
something. Yeah, I can just, but I think I know what it is, so let's just go there. I found it this way really easily. One more time. So let's go here to. The reason I didn't want to have to type in his name.
Is it very long? Oh, is it Neil Swami or whatever like that?
No,
I was right.
Yes.
Yeah. No, he's really good.
So I'm going to put in the closed captions, even though you can't see them, unfortunately. So let's look there on. Looks like that.
I can join anyone in the beach song. I
make memories for people I don't know yet. I know this view is too good not to share. I am a verbal horse. About a decade ago, I met someone who had experienced a few episodes of schizophrenia. They have felt that their sense of self, of what it feels like to be them, changing somewhat. The boundaries of the body began to feel a bit nebulous.
Is this a good volume level?
Yes.
Yes, okay, good, because the speakers here aren't good. Okay, so here we go.
Even their psychological self felt a bit porous at times. They were experiencing what could be called an altered sense of self. Over the years, I met many such brave and insightful people who shared what it's like to live with their altered selves. And by altered, I mean different, not deficient, while acknowledging that coping with altered selves can be a struggle at times. So speaking with them and with theologians, philosophers, neuroscientists, I came to understand that this self that each one of us takes oneself to be is not as real as it seems. The self is a slippery subject. We all intuitively know what it means. It's there when we wake up, it disappears when we fall asleep, it reappears in our dreams. It's what makes us who we are. It seems solid, unchanging, permanent. And yet, we can examine aspects of the self that seem real to us and ask just how real are they. Take, for instance, the question, who am I? The most likely answer you'll get or give to such a question will be in the form of a story. We tell others and indeed ourselves stories about who we are. We take our stories to be sacrosanct. We are our stories. But a condition that most of us, sadly, will be familiar with, Alzheimer's disease, tells us something quite different. Alzheimer's begins by affecting short-term memory. Think about what that does to someone's story. In order for our stories to form, to grow, something that just happens to us has to first enter short-term memory and then get incorporated into what's called long-term episodic memory. It has to become an episode in our narrative. But what if the experience doesn't even enter short-term memory? That's exactly what Alzheimer's does. In the beginning, Alzheimer's impairs the formation of short-term memory. It impairs the growth of the narrative. It's as if our stories begin stalling upon the onset of the disease. Eventually, Alzheimer's eats away at older, long-term memories. So if you were to meet someone with mid-stage Alzheimer's, they will likely be able to tell you stories about who they are. But if you know their real stories, you'll be able to tell that they sometimes scramble up their narrative, that they sometimes mix up the sequence of episodes from their lives. It's as if they are recalling their own stories in ways that are not quite accurate. It's important at this stage to realize that there is still a person experiencing that scrambled narrative. Sadly, Alzheimer's goes on to destroy one's narrative and so much more. And towards the end, it's unclear whether there is still someone experiencing something because the person cannot communicate verbally anymore. And yet, Alzheimer's tells us that these stories that we take ourselves to be, what philosophers call the narrative self, these are spun by the brain and body. They are constructions. Sometimes the constructions are disrupted, even destroyed. And while that is horrific for the person experiencing it and for their caregivers, it is nonetheless a window onto the constructed nature of our narrative self. And when the construction goes wrong, we perceive our own stories in ways that are not quite real. From the narrative self, let's talk about our body. Let's take a very basic aspect of our bodily self. This feeling we all have that we are owners of our body and body parts. That our bodies and body parts belong to us. It seems such a strange thing to think that it could even be otherwise. If I were to ask you, does your hand belong to you? You're going to say, of course it does. What a foolish question. But not everyone would agree. Early on in my research, a neuropsychologist alerted me to a condition called xenomelia, or foreign limb syndrome. You may have heard of something called phantom limb syndrome, in which people who have had an amputation feel the presence of that limb sometimes. Xenomelia is somewhat of an opposite condition, where people feel like some part of their body, usually the extremities of their hands or legs, don't belong to them. So this neuropsychologist talked of phantom limb syndrome as animation without incarnation. So the limb is gone, it's not incarnate anymore, but it's animated in your mind. And he talked of xenomelia as incarnation without animation. So the limb is present, healthy even, incarnate, and yet in your own mind it feels like it doesn't belong to you. So, in xenomelia, the brain and bodily processes that give rise to our sense of ownership of our body parts, they're misfiring, so to speak. And the consequences can be serious. People with xenomelia will sometimes take extreme measures to get rid of, to amputate their foreign-seeming body parts. From the perspective of the self, though, xenomelia is telling us something very profound. It's telling us that something as basic as the sense of ownership of our own body parts is a construction. And sometimes the construction goes wrong and we perceive our own bodies in ways that are not quite real. Let's take another aspect of our bodily self. It's called the sense of agency. So when I do something like pick up a cup, I have this implicit feeling that I am the agent of that action, that I have willed that action into existence. That feeling is the sense of agency. But someone with schizophrenia may not have that feeling always. Someone with schizophrenia might do something and not feel like they are the agent of that action. So schizophrenia tells us that it is possible to be someone who does something but doesn't have an accompanying sense of agency. So just like the narrative self and the sense of ownership of body parts, the sense of agency is also a construction and it too can fail. So you can see where this is going. Let me take one more example to drive home this point. Let's talk of what it feels to be a body here and now. Not the feeling of being a story, but the feeling of being a body in the present moment. Psychologists estimate that about 5% of the general population will at some point in their lives have an out-of-body experience. Let's assume all of us right now are having an in-body experience. But what that means is having this feeling of being in a body, being anchored to a body, occupying a certain volume of space, and looking at the world from behind our eyes. But if you are having an out-of-body experience, you could possibly be feeling that you're up near the ceiling, looking down at your own body, sitting in the chair below. People do report such experiences. And mild versions of this have been replicated in labs. But if you think, like I do, that out-of-body experiences are the outcome of brain processes that are misfiring, then it stands to reason that the experience of being in-body, of being embodied, is itself a construction, and that too can come apart. So what are these experiences of altered selves telling us? They are telling us that just about everything we take to be real about ourselves, real in the sense that we think we are always experiencing undeniable truths about our bodies, our stories, well, that's just not the case. So, when theologians and philosophers tell us that the self is an illusion, this is partly what they mean. You may have realized by now that there still remains the question of who or what is doing the experiencing, even in the case of altered selves. This experiencing I, in the question, who am I, is at the heart of the debate about the self. This experiencing I doesn't go away if one or a few aspects of the self are disrupted. But what if all of the aspects of the self that comprise us were to be disrupted? Would the experiencing I disappear? We don't have a satisfactory answer to that question yet. it's possible that the experiencing I is also an illusion, in the sense of being a construction without a constructor. That debate, however, is somewhat unresolved. Despite such doubts, I personally, whatever I am, think that the self has no reality outside of the brain and body. I think that the experiencing I will not persist after the body is gone. So, what does one make of such knowledge? Well, firstly, these ideas will feel liberating to some and might sit heavily upon others. Regardless, I think we can all attend to the stories that we think we are. Our feelings and emotions are modulated by our stories. And in turn, our feelings and emotions become part of our stories. And our stories, our narratives, are not just cognitive. They live in our bodies. And our bodies structure and shape our stories. So knowing all this, recognizing the constructed nature of it all, maybe we can hold on less tightly to our stories. Maybe we can learn to let go. But that's easier said than done, because the thing that is doing the letting go is also the thing that has to be let go of. Maybe we can just marvel at the efforts of people over millennia, from the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree to the modern philosopher and neuroscientist, who have asked themselves the question, who am I? But most of all, I think we owe a debt to those amongst us who bravely bear witness to our altered selves, whether we do so voluntarily, like monks and nuns do when they meditate, or whether it's brought upon us by biology and circumstance. There is something remarkably robust about the processes that give rise to the totality of our sense of self. But there's something frighteningly fragile about them too. They can crack. And any one of us at any time in our life may have to confront such cracks. And that knowledge, I believe, should make us empathetic towards those of us dealing with altered selves. But I also believe that altered selves should not be seen as the outcome of deficits or as the outcome of a lack of attributes considered normal. They are different ways of being. And it's the willingness of some of us to confront the self's constructed nature that is helping make sense of the self for all of us. Thank you.
Autobiographical self. And this is the level of the self that he's a science writer, that orthodox science has identified. And it's also the level that the Buddhists have identified. When they talk about the Buddhists, in Buddhist thought there are supposedly three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, three great understandings that came from Buddhism. The first came from the Buddha, and that had to do with the nature of suffering and the fact that there is release from suffering through non-attachment. The Eightfold Way and the Four Noble Truths. That's the first turning. The fact that you can not suffer if you're not attached to external events. That's the first turning. The third turning is Buddha nature. We're going there in a while. But the second turning is anatta, no self. It's a very hard lesson. The idea that if you sit in meditation long enough, you see that there is no self. So that's the narrative, autobiographical level. Neuroscience psychologically? Where does it come from? The top of the brain, the cerebral cortex, various areas of the cerebral cortex. And people have tried to, are trying to identify where the various aspects of that narration happen. Antonio Damasio talks about the insular cortex. There's also a part of the cortex that, on the left side, that has to do with making stories. So this is stuff that humans have a lot of, and that animals with less cerebral cortex have less of. So your dog, nobody knows that, but I'm guessing your dog has some narrative sense of self, but not a lot. And then lower down, maybe no. The dog doesn't, there's a different level of self. It's not, the dog is not saying, I am blah, 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 but there's an emotional self that we'll get to. That's a different level. Okay, the dog has more of that than I do. Michael.
My question would be in terms of personal experiences with hallucinogenic drugs and the impact that that might have on the perception of self. Have they done studies on that? Do you know of? Because for me, those experiences have sometimes sort of shattered the self, but left me open to the all, let's say.
Hold that question, because I'm about to go there.
Oh.
Of course. I mean, a lot of us are going, wait a minute, there's more to it than this. We're getting there in a minute, okay? But at this level, you know, the orthodox science level, the self is a constructed, sometimes ill-constructed thing, and a lot of psychotherapy has to do with changing the narrative. You know that. You change the story, you change how a person feels and how they act, and that's what a lot of modern psychotherapy is all about, is let's get the story out, let's see where it came from, let's see if we can redraft the story. That will change you. Mike.
The term narrative self implies language.
Yeah.
So a dog wouldn't have a narrative self because he doesn't have language.
Well, a dog has a little bit of language. They're not very good at verbalizing, but they do verbalize to some extent. They make different sounds to tell you to do different things. They can recognize the sound of their own voice and various commands. So there is some, they don't have no cerebral cortex, they just don't have a lot of it. At least mine does. Anyway, that's the level, I think, that the Buddhists, speaking for people that I shouldn't be speaking for, but the idea of when you look at the self from the Buddhist point of view, that level of the self falls away. That is, you see that that's a bunch of thoughts. That's what Eckhart Tolle said too, right? He said, when you start thinking, then yourself comes into being. It's what René Descartes said. I think, therefore I am. So this is an old idea that you come into being with your story about yourself, the thoughts you know, the words you say about who you are. Is there a deeper level of self than that? If you remember, I have no episodic memory at all. I think earlier this term, but it may have been last term, that I showed you the video by Antonio Damasio on the self. And he said there are three levels of self that he's a neuroscientist at the university at USC. And he said there are three levels of self. There's the level we just talked about, the autobiographical self. He said there's a core self and then a proto self. The proto self isn't conscious. It's something the body is doing. The brain stem is constantly monitoring the body. And on the basis of what it finds, it's altering body function. So that's what your brainstem does. It just makes sure that your heartbeat is appropriate, and your breathing is appropriate, and your blood pressure is appropriate. That's brainstem function. And that's always information coming in, and then the brainstem and other structures in the brain changing those levels so that everything stays alive. So he called that the level that you don't experience, he called that the proto-self. But he said that when you tune in to that basic sense of me that never goes away, anytime you're awake, you have a sense of me. And that's a sense of something looking. It's a sense of, I always have, I'm looking out at the stories I tell myself, at you, but there's a looker. Even if there are no stories, there's a looker. If you get a meditation and the stories quiet down, there's still a looker. He called that the core self. And he said, that's the brain stem. And you're consciously experiencing the brain stem's alertness without any overlay of emotion or thought. When you first wake up in the morning, the very first thing you pass through the hypnopompic state, and in the hypnopompic state, there's at least a moment, and longer if you linger there, when there is just an awareness and there is no content to it. And that's enlightenment, from my point of view, which we pass through every morning without realizing it. But that's just the looker, not what is the things that are experienced. And that's the level that a lot of us as meditators have a lot of trouble with, because they keep saying there's no self, and we keep saying, yeah, but there is. There's some experiencer. Even if there's no experience, there's a capacity to have experience, and that is who we are. Again, from a neuroscience point of view, that's brainstem function as you're aware of, without the overlay of emotion and limbic system and cerebral cortex, emotion and thought.
Sorry, is the brainstem the proto-self or the core self?
The brainstem is the proto-self when you're not aware of it. Because it's happening all the time. And when you're aware of it, it's the core self. So he makes that distinction. It's a kind of fuzzy distinction. It's really the same thing. So that's that second level of an experiencer, no matter what the experience is. Is there a deeper level than that? That's a problem that many meditators spend their lives trying to understand, me included. Does that perspective change, or does it open up somehow? Now we'll get to the second of these two videos I wanted to show you, which may ring true for many of you in one way or another. This is a particular method by which the basic nature of who we are seems to become evident. A deeper level of self than the two that I talked about. This is not the only way that this stuff happens. In fact, there are many technologies of the sacred throughout history and throughout cultures. This is just the hot current one.
You know where we're going with this, I think.
It'll take me a moment to find this. Not too long, I don't think.
And now turn the lights on.
By the way, it should be more audible. That last one was kind of fuzzy. This one, I think, should come through better. This video, it takes a couple of minutes. It doesn't start out great, but after a minute or two, it does. It does become that way. So,
thank you.
All of us are people whose lives have been touched by tragedy, depression, and despair. I believe it's because we're disconnected and that there's a way back to connection, and that's what I'm here to talk about. Over 30 years ago, I listened to a program by Dr. Leo Buscaglia. It was simply called Love. Dr. Buscaglia is a professor at the University of Southern California, and a student in one of his classes committed suicide. It was devastating to him that someone could feel so alone and so disconnected, and that he hadn't known she was suffering, nor had others. He felt compelled to do something about it, and he began exploring the ideas of disconnectedness and the meaning of life, and after a lot of soul searching, started a non-credit course at USC called Love 1A, teaching the importance of human connection. Since college, I've been searching to confirm my belief that love was the most important thing in life, that it was life. I'm one of those people always asking, who am I? Why am I here? What's the meaning of life? One semester, rather than going to one of my classes, I'd gone to an encounter group. It turned out to be an extraordinary experience of love and connection that lasted long after. And here was Dr. Buscaglia teaching love. I remember so clearly saying to myself, that's what I want to do. What could be more exciting, more interesting, but truly more important? So who would have imagined more than 30 years later, I'd be standing here talking to you about love. And that mushrooms got me here. Since 2000, I've been working in the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in a research with psilocybin, or as many refer to it, magic mushrooms. We have conducted multiple studies with psilocybin, including cancer end of life with anxiety and depression, smoking cessation, and major depressive disorder, among others. We recently received a $17 million grant to open a center for psychedelic and consciousness research and build on our work. We will be conducting a wide range of studies, from anorexia nervosa and early stage Alzheimer's to PTSD and opioid addiction. The grant is impressive and it reflects the success of our research. Here are some findings from our cancer study at the 6-month follow-up. Approximately 80% showed clinically significant decreases in anxiety and depression. And almost 70% called it one of the top 5 spiritually significant experiences of their lives. There is a lasting impact for many of our study volunteers. Our smoking cessation pilot study outcomes, although just 15 people, is unprecedented, more than double the average abstinent rates. 80% were abstinent at the 6-month follow-up, 67% at the 12-month follow-up, and 60% at the 2.5-year follow-up. And preliminary results of our depression study at the 1-month follow-up, almost 70% of our 24 volunteers showed clinically significant improvement, and 50% full remission to normal. Depression is a vexing problem. For half of our volunteers to be in full remission is remarkable if these results hold over time. It could be a major breakthrough in treatment for depression. And through my time at Hopkins, I have had the extraordinarily privileged position of witnessing hundreds of these volunteer sessions. And what I have seen emerge is the core of the experience is love and connection, a reconnecting to our true, authentic self. For many, these experiences gave voice to something unexpected, a realization that confirmed these beliefs. One volunteer said, I was full of love and joy and connection. It was an awesome outpouring of love. It really struck me vividly that love is home. It is natural and present when obstacles are removed. Study volunteers come to us with a wide range of issues, and you've seen some of the measurable results of the psilocybin experience. I imagine some of you may think these results are unbelievable. It may even lead you to want to go out and try it on your own. But our studies are very different from recreational use with friends and at parties. That's one of the very reasons I'm giving this talk, because I believe that results like ours depend on good study design. Our studies are structured in three parts. The preparation meetings are where we begin to establish the relationship, the connection with our volunteers, which is essential to provide a safe environment that allows them to trust us, their guides, to give them the courage to be vulnerable and share very intimate parts of their lives without the fear of being rejected. I think we have all had the experience of speaking an undisclosed truth, of divulging something that was buried inside and feeling lighter after, like taking off a mask and revealing ourselves. Intimate conversation is one of the most important practices to assist in the self-disclosure. It's amazing how many times volunteers tell us that they've shared things they've never told anyone before. Sexual assault, wanting to leave their partner, lying, cheating. Some say it's the first time they've been fully seen. And almost all our volunteers tell us how valuable these meetings are. One said, had it not been for the two experienced researchers in the room, I probably would have had a full-blown panic attack and lost the larger experience. Psilocybin is strong medicine. It can be overwhelming. Being prepared for the experience is critical. The preparation enables our volunteers to relax and let go into the second phase, the psilocybin session. When we are tense or blocked, we don't allow the flow. Being relaxed allows this expansion and access to states of consciousness that often bring about a mystical experience that most of our volunteers endorse. Mystical experiences are characterized by a transcendence of time and space, deeply felt positive mood, a sense of sacredness, and love and connection to all of life. But it's important to point out that not all our volunteers benefit from our studies, that you don't have to have a mystical experience to have a meaningful or transformative experience, and that these sessions are not always easy. In fact, they can be quite difficult. In preparation, we address possible difficulties, how to stay with them and navigate them during the session, and to see them as an important and meaningful part of the process. I have been witness to many volunteer sessions that were both difficult and had no mystical component at all, and yet were deeply meaningful and transformative. And this brings us back to love and connection. Study after study, volunteer after volunteer, session report after session report, I see the same themes emerge. We are love. The present moment is all there is. There's an interconnectedness to all of life and a deep-rooted knowingness of our true, authentic self. The psilocybin experience offers a means to reconnect to the present, our true nature, our authentic self, to love. One volunteer said this of his experience. It is a total connection with the universe. It is a state of awareness beyond description. Profound, yet one has the deep knowingness that this is our true reality. There's also incredible joy. Hearing the laughter of someone feeling love and connection on a deep level is unlike anything else. Joy itself can be a breakthrough. One of our cancer study volunteers, who had been joyless for years, wrote that this experience was meaningful to her long after the session was over, describing how she began laughing out loud and how that joyful experience put her back in touch with a feeling she thought impossible to ever have again. And finally, we incorporate these experiences into day-to-day life. Integration is a key component of each study. Otherwise, it would just be an experience. Integration is weaving the mystical into the practical, bringing the meaning of the psilocybin sessions into daily life. I have observed significant increases in quality of life and personal meaning. Priority shifting, awareness of what's important, and letting go of what's not. Increases in patience, and increases in a core sense of self. These are some of the observations that reveal the lasting impact that we see in our follow-ups at 1, 6, 12, and some at 14 months. But it's not just the psilocybin that does this. It's the relationship we establish, the awareness the volunteer experiences during the session, and the integration after. This work and nearly 400 study volunteers is what has kept me at Hopkins for 20 years. It is my relationship, my connection with them. That is how I see my role as a psychedelic guide. That is what makes my work so fulfilling, because to me, relationships are what make our lives meaningful. Our studies explore the same questions that had me listening intently to that love program years ago. Only now, rather than my personal exploration, it is that of our study volunteers. Who are you? Why are you here in the study at this time? And what's the meaning of your life? And each person has their own unique exploration. And yet, there's a universal experience too. A deep sense of love and connection to all. One of our depression volunteers told me that she did not feel alone anymore, and she summed it up beautifully. Such an amazing gift that I have been given. Not only the realization of inner peace, but the feeling of connection that I have reestablished for every human on this planet. When Leo Biscaglia was faced with a dilemma of how to make sense of the student who felt so disconnected that she took her life, he chose to start a class in love, knowing that love is the ultimate healer. So imagine the thrill for someone who wanted to do what Dr. Biscaglia did when I took this job, uncertain at first of its value or impact, and found our volunteers confirming this belief over and over, telling me their experiences revealed these simple truths. We are all one, we are all connected, we are all love. That is the potential of the psychedelic medicines, to show us who we really are and what truly matters, and thereby help us to heal ourselves and then the world. So now, imagine a friend or a loved one, or perhaps even yourself, entering one of our studies, struggling with an addiction, thoughts of suicide, or one of the disorders I've mentioned today. Now, imagine that same person exiting our study and reporting that their predominant and lasting feeling is one of love and connection. And now, imagine yourself saying and believing what this volunteer said. I am love. I am in love. Love is in me. I breathe love. I am loved. Thank you.
So could we have the everything opened up, and we'll see.
Oh.
So each person is going to get one of these, and I don't know how to do this. Do you want to get up, or shall we'll pass them out? Maybe. Okay. So we'll give you those, and somebody with a mic. Thank you. Would you pass them out too? And we need more about Flynn. But I think that might be enough. Just one page. No, that's not true. The third pretty of the Dharma is Buddha nature.
Yeah, but there is no essence.
She's a Buddhist.
Well, now. She's started Buddha.
Thank you. Yeah, oh, absolutely. I got tons of them. Thank you, Michael. All right, so let's read this together. By the way, about psychedelic medicine, I'm going to give a lecture to the psych club at City College, so I'm going to have to get up to speed about all the latest studies and stuff, so I'll probably bring that in toward the end of our class, a little bit more about it. I know we can talk a lot about it, but I don't want to do that now. I want to explore this third level of self, for want of a better word, the essential self, because that's what she calls it, or the essence. And those of us who are scientifically trained, just take this as a possibility, you know? I just try to stay open to some of this stuff that experientially is a little bit beyond me, but it's interesting. Enough people have said it in enough contexts so that I open myself to learning about it. Okay. So, I guess I'll read, because otherwise we have to move fairly swiftly. So,
essence is the pure unconditioned nature of who we are. The purest unconditioned means unlearned. The purest fiber of our being is more fundamental and intrinsic than our personality. Essence is that which cannot be reduced or removed. Is always present, always available, and always rising in us. It is a permanent abiding presence. I think that's an important line. It's a permanent abiding presence. Its basic quality is its existence as an ontological actuality, a suchness. Essence is the pure and authentic presence of our being. Its presence is its primary action. Essence is our true nature. It is being without the distortion of our personal history, so it doesn't have the narrative, it's not narrative. Essence isn't alive, it is aliveness. Essence isn't aware, it is awareness. Essence isn't loving, it is love. Essence isn't being true, it is truth. Personality versus truth. When essence expresses itself into our lives on a personal level, it manifests as various experiential qualities that are clearly discernible. So this is something extra individual that manifests on a personal level, and these are the qualities that we discern on a personal level based on what is deeper, such as the warmth of compassion, the sweetness of love, the stillness of peace, the solidity of will, and the fire of strength. These qualities and others, in their purest form, are our potential. They are the essential qualities of our being. However, even though essence and the essential qualities are always there and always available to us, we live through life's experiences and become wounded in various ways. We end up abandoning them and losing awareness of their presence. We forget how to access them. Another way to put this is, life causes us to chronically close in various ways, and we forget this level of universal openness. When we lose contact with the experience and presence of our essence and its essential qualities, we literally feel a hole or emptiness or deficiency in ourselves. Most often, this is frightening and painful. One of the characteristics of the ego slash personality is that it feels it must compensate for this loss. It feels it must and can substitute for it. There's a certain kind of ego pride in its, our ability to do this for ourselves. And it does its best to provide what is needed to ease the pain and fill the hole of deficiency. The ego feels it can create its own strength, its own love, its own security, whatever it needs. However,
I've got some of these are double-sided and some are single-sided. I hope you didn't get a single-sided. If you got a single-sided one, do you need another side? Anybody get a single-sided one? I didn't realize.
However, the compensations that it uses only mimic the essential qualities, and rather than originating from essence, they are rooted in the defensive avoidance of life's pain. So there's a level of self that tries to compensate for not being aware of this essential level, and that level is the personality or ego level. Each time that people compensate for an essential quality, they're actually distancing themselves from the experience of their essential nature, from the truth of who they truly are. Living our lives and identifying ourselves solely as a personality relegates us to live within the confines of the nature of the personality, which can be a deficient hole, H-O-L-E, vacant of authentic existence. The kind of person we try to be to compensate for our lack is not who we truly are. Which is why surrender comes in, when that fails eventually. Essence is a presence that exists purely as itself. It has nothing to do with the identifications and compensations of the personality. However, it is very important to know that the flow of essence into our lives is structured and experienced by either the spin of our personality or by the recognition of our essential being. It is who we think we are, what we identify with, that influences the quality of our experience of essence as it flows into our life, and whether we're even aware of its presence. If we're strongly identified with our personality, we won't easily recognize essence and its qualities when it presents to us. As we awaken to this knowing, we're free to become aware of the subtle realms of self slash self and discover more of who we are. We can inquire further into what comprises us, our personality, our essential core, and open to the experience of the complexity of our being. The beauty of our individual consciousness and uniqueness, the means by which being manifests and experiences itself, blossoms forth. Let me read that again. The beauty of our individual consciousness and uniqueness. So that's not... we're each a unique expression of this deeper self. The means by which being manifests and experiences itself, blossoms forth. As the integration takes place, there's a manifestation of the qualities of a personal essence, autonomy, competence, respect, dignity, integrity, excellence, maturity, harmony, completeness. This is our birthright. And as we learn to recognize essence and its qualities, it is helpful to know what it is not. Essence is not energy. It is the source of energy. And its presence frees or activates our energy. That is kundalini, chi, prana. It also activates our nervous and other physical systems, but it is not the discharge or the emotion. Essence is not a feeling. It is experience as a felt sense that is different from a feeling. That is, you might feel your fingers, but the feeling is not your fingers. Also, it is important not to get caught in the trap of pursuing positive emotions and mistaking them for essence. Essence is not an image. The presence of essence stimulates our minds to produce profound images that are very meaningful to us and our process. However, to focus on the image as the desired end is missing the image's source. as Matthew Fox said, one river, many wells. Or as Joe Campbell said, people kill themselves over the image they have of that which is what unites them. Reclaiming essential experience. So how do we get there? What do we do to reconnect to the experience of our essential nature and qualities of being? How do we proceed? First, we work on the personality, softening the structures of the psyche that have been created by the ego. As we do that, we create space for essence to rise into our experience and awareness. If you meditate and you let go and you soften and open, you're creating that space. Essence can be very subtle as it comes into our experience, so we must develop a new sensitivity to the subtle levels of being. To do this, we must become quiet and present to the moment, present to the now, present to the truth of whatever we are experiencing in the moment. Truth is dynamic, and as we stay with the truth of whatever we're experiencing, it shifts and changes, revealing further truth. As we continue to stay with this dynamic unfolding, we're involved in a profound alchemical process that is actually metabolizing and softening the structure of the psyche and healing what needs to be healed. It is elegant and precise. What Stan Grof says is there's a natural progression that happens in the psyche if you open to it. There's a natural growth and healing process that happens. It's just part of being alive, if you don't block it. This process of allowing whatever arises to arise in your consciousness, this process may be uncomfortable. However, as we stay with it, eventually we come to an experience of calm, quiet, openness. It is extremely important to stay with the truth of the experience of this experience as well. For this is when essence returns and reveals itself to us once again. It is subtle, yet pure and profound, a felt sense of the discernible quality that is returning to you. Whatever essential quality returns to your experience is the very one you were forced to abandon as a child. That's really interesting. Whatever essential quality returns to your experience is the very one that you were forced to abandon as a child. As you stay with your essential experience and allow it to fill you completely, you're being healed in a deep way. Little by little, your experience of the return of essence will reveal your true identity, the purest fiber of your being, your essential nature. The many qualities of essence, like facets of a diamond, are remembered rather than learned. It is the return of essence that, in the end, fulfills us.
So, Let's talk a little about it. We have 5 minutes or so. What do you want to say about this? I'm going to pass the mic around. Is that something that I can do? So if you want to talk, or you can yell, one or the other. Let me put this on and pass the mic around. See who wants to. Now, if you didn't get the 2 pages, come up and I'll give you the second page, okay? Because some of these were 1 page, some of these were. You didn't get the second page. So who wants to talk? Who would like to comment?
Is this the third level of self?
Say again?
The essence?
This is the third level of self. Okay. The deepest level of self. Okay? So, who would like to... So, Betsy is first and then Mike. Okay, so let me just...
I think that Lynn Lowry said that.
Okay, yeah, we're ready to have
Betsy. So, I'm going to teach
you
the Enneagram. Yes. And the Enneagram is an ancient study that deals currently with personalities, and basically it's all about essential qualities. And what you're saying is that we have these essential qualities of life when we're born, or we have a flavor of one of them more than the others. Like the essential qualities are being, alignment, reciprocity, love, functionality, authenticity, intelligence, attention, freedom, and aliveness. And all those things exist all the time. And so the idea is when you're born, you have a flavor of one of those, and you're trying to, just like you said, you're trying to bring it back into the world. So because you're distorted and you're young and you don't know how to do that, because that's your defense mechanism. It's your ego. It's your one-two personality emotional punch. You know, the ego that you end up defending that essential quality. I always say, everybody wants my energy that I put out, but they don't want it from me. So it's the life force energy that gives my personality and identity. And yet that energy can really be, if I overdo it, but everybody wants that, because everybody has life force energy in them. But they don't have that intimate relationship at birth that they're trying to bring it back. And one of the any types does, and then another any type has an intimate relationship with love, or authenticity, or functionality, or being. The person that you know, for instance, that merges with you and that always makes you feel smarter and more loved than you really are, that's an any type 9, because their essential quality is being. And they want to teach everyone how to be in the world. And so that's why they are. So it just was a good segue to what you're talking about, because it is a tool to understand how your personality got involved with trying to bring back an essential quality that exists in all of us and in life.
So that, Betsy is going to teach us a class in the Enneagram in about a month. And so we can go further into this. So if you got a little taste of what you're going to get from Betsy end of March, right? Something like that.
Right, right. Yeah. But
then,
so it's all about
the essence. Yes. Thank you, Betsy. I'm looking forward to that class very much.
I didn't know how I was going to structure it, but now I know how I'll base it.
Ah, perfect. Okay, so Mike, we're going to give you this thing, this and this.
So hold it like this, about 2 inches away from your face, and then I'm going to wipe it down each time.
I couldn't help but think whether...
Put it up a little bit. Okay, Mike, go for it.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Does that work?
Yeah.
Whether this is an aspirational article, or whether... it's really discerning a level of self. You see, she says, if you don't have these things, it's a lack of not who we truly are. Well, maybe there are people that simply lack those things, and that's how they truly are. They don't have that, what we're calling a third level of self. Isn't that possible?
No, not from this point of view. Maybe so, but from this point of view, they're closed off from that essential level, and their personality has taken over badly, not completely, the functions that should be from this deeper level. So, and that's the case for a lot of us, is we don't have this, and we feel like this is fantasy, or this is somebody else's reality, not ours. Our reality is our personality. What the argument here is that the personality is a simulacrum of this larger essence, and that the personality basically fails to give us the satisfaction that we want. And that's what you remember. You know that guy Dante Alighieri? I don't know how he pronounced his last name, but you know the Divine Comedy guy? It starts out something like, in the middle of my life, I found myself lost in a dark forest. And the metaphor that he's talking about is, I did everything right, personality-wise, and at some point I started to feel something was not there that should be there. And that's the middle of life, or the later part of life, that Jung said, when you start this quest, this spiritual quest. The Brahmins, the third, the highest caste of Hindus, say there are three stages to life, about 28 years each. First stage is, 36, yeah, that's about right. First stage is childhood and education. Second stage is family and work. And then about age 56, you take the ochre robe and you leave everything and you go into the forest as a mendicant and a sadhu, trying to find out what the deeper nature of reality is. We don't have that in our culture. We just try to make a stronger and stronger ego. But what's being said by a lot of people is that people don't really get fulfilled that way. They only get fulfilled in terms of their relationships. And their relationships are a smaller form of a greater love. So the way that many of us experience this universal, the love that moves the stars, you know, is we experience it in terms of the people that we connect, the love that we have. But that's a smaller form of a greater existence that we really are, people say. Now this would all be, again, ancient writings, except for the fact that we have experiences like this in various states of consciousness, or just sometimes spontaneously, like at the Grand Canyon. I had a friend that had a mystical experience just by looking at the Grand Canyon. And that mystical experience blows you out of yourself to a larger existence. And it used to be called psychosis, you know. But now we realize that that's called mystical experience, and that transforms people for the better in profound ways, either in psychedelic therapy or in church or whatever way. So what most people, what people in this camp would say is there's a larger sense of who you are than the one that we generally walk around with. I guess we got to quit for today. I wish I could like do a scan of everybody's mind here, because some people are like, of course, how can people not know this? And other people are like, what? What are you talking about? This is gobbledygook. So I should have a poll. Okay, I have people in this camp. People in this camp. But this is certainly something worth considering if we're going to do a class in the basic nature of who we are in reality. These are levels of understanding that need to be contemplated anyway. So have a great week. Stay wet. I'll see you next week when Carl talks to us about the new one. If anybody needs another copy of this video.